Introducing the new low-fat Subway Buffalo Chicken. Spicy chicken, cool light ranch, one hot sandwich. All the flavor you love with 7 grams of fat. For a limited time, hurry to Subway and enjoy the newest part of a Subway Fresh Fit meal. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, let's get right to it. Our old friend Chuck Klosterman has a new book out called Eating the Dinosaur, a new collection of essays, none of which you have ever read. And now he's on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Chuck Klosterman, what's happening?
Everything.
Everything, as always. Big book coming out.
A book coming out. Not that big.
Kind of big? A little big?
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Are you talking physically or metaphorically?
Well, you haven't had a book of essays in a while. This is your first book of essays since...
That's true.
Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs.
Yeah, I suppose the Chuck Klosterman 4 book was kind of like... There were essays in it, but they had been published before. This is the first set of new ones.
So when did you start working on it?
When did I start working on it? I guess it would have been right around the time when you called me in Germany last year.
Oh.
I think that's when I began. At the time, I remember I was just starting. I had this idea that I was going to do a book about the 90s. That was my original concept. I was thinking, you've probably read the 50s, Hilversheim's book, The 50s.
Yes.
Yeah.
A little long.
I read that, and I was like, well, you know, it's interesting because that book about the 50s had been written in the early 90s, or came out in the early 90s. But because everything's so accelerated now, it seemed as though a book about the 90s would have to come out in a much shorter window, much closer. So that was my original plan.
Right.
And there were certain things I wanted to write about specifically from that period. But then it seemed almost kind of strangely constrictive. Like I was, the whole thing was becoming this, almost like this gimmick of writing about this specific span, and I had to jam every idea into that kind of window of time. So then I just decided I would just write about whatever interests me, and it just kind of became a normal essay book.
That's interesting, because when I did my book, I kind of started out the same way. I had a general idea of what would happen, and then it totally shifted as the process went along. It seems like some people, they love to do outlines for it, and before they start the book, they know exactly what it's going to be.
When it was going to be a 90s book, I actually did have an outline, which I had never done before.
Wow.
Of course, I didn't use it.
Well, because you felt constricted by it.
Well, yeah, I knew the first essay I wrote is the one in the book about the In Utero record and the Branch Davidians.
Yep.
I knew I was going to write about that. I knew I was going to write about the Unabomber. And there were a few other things I wanted to, I knew those, so I wrote those two first.
Yeah.
But then some of the other ideas, it seemed almost like there was a concept I wanted to write about, and I was trying to figure out a way to make it connected to, like, 1996 or whatever. So that's when I decided that it was just too much. It became, the whole book seemed like it was going to become just structure. The structure was everything. And yeah. A lot of times when you're trying to come up with a book or, when you're trying to present it to the publisher or whatever, the structure is kind of more important than the content. Then when you start writing, the structure kind of evaporates and it only becomes about the content. So then I just seemed crazy to write a book that wasn't what I wanted to do just because it seemed to fit together better.
How much, if the book, or at least the advance proof that you sent me, was 229 pages, is there content that you wrote that you decided not to include?
Let me think. No.
There's no deleted scenes?
Nothing that got left out.
No deleted scene chapters?
No, if I write something, and it does, like, if I go through the process of writing the entire essay, like,
yeah.
I mean, I might stop a page or two into something, I might start writing something and quit. But if I write an entire essay, I'll just keep reworking it until I feel like I can use it.
Do you ever do multiple at the same time, or do you, I'm going to write this one essay and I'm going to keep plugging away until I quit, or do you do two or three at the same time?
I just do one at a time.
Interesting.
I usually do one at a time, in order, straight through.
And then you just keep tinkering until it's done. Do you ever go back, like, 3 weeks later and say, I'm going to take one more swing at this?
What do you mean by swing?
Well, you think you're done, but you're like, I need to let this breathe for about 3 weeks. And I'll come back in 3 weeks. Yeah. Okay.
I never really consider that swinging, though. That's more like kind of...
tinkering.
Check swinging. I take a lot of check swings.
A tinker.
In retrospect.
So if you'd done the 90s book, would there have been an overall theme? Like, what just happened? Or
I'm afraid if I talk about this idea, people will think this is what the book was. But I will tell you what the original idea was. The original idea was that I was going to write an essay about every year from 1981 up until an essay about what the world was like on September 10th of 2001.
Which
was to signify the end. That was going to be the last essay. And I wasn't going to mention 9/11 at all. I was just going to talk about everything up before it. Because, you know, there was a lot of weird news at that time. There was the missing girl with the politician, and there was the shark attacks. It was the summer of the shark attacks and all that. So, you know, that was going to be the end of it. And I was going to, at one point, I wanted to sort of write about torture. And I was going to write about torture kind of through the context of Jeannie Garth's character in 90210. Because I feel like over time the writers really tortured her. You know, they burned her, made her a lesbian, had her join a cult. You know, she got addicted to cocaine. It was almost as though her character was only existed sort of to have these sort of kind of weird, perverse things to happen to her. And I was going to try, you know, so I was going to use stuff like that to talk about these kind of tangential ideas, like just the depiction of torture in media.
And she got kidnapped.
But then, what?
And she got kidnapped.
She got kidnapped. Oh, there's a bunch of things.
By her stalker.
Everything happened to her, you know?
Yeah. You know what the problem was there? Is that they had too many episodes per season. Like, when you're cranking out, like, 30 episodes or whatever they were doing... You run out of things to do with the characters, and you run out of combinations.
Well,
for
you know,
to hook up
now when you go, when they show it, like they show those episodes on the soap opera network now. Now it's to their advantage because that was a show I felt like I watched when it was on. I constantly see episodes I've never seen before. I constantly feel like I see characters I've never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if Mad Men had to do 30 episodes a year. I'm going to say it's a different show.
There would have to be a lot more killing time in the office, I guess.
Yeah, there'd be your Don Draper. He's boozing a little too hard, gets in the DUI or DWI accident, and he's in the hospital. Like, they'd have to do all these soap opera tactics. That's people. They never account with this with the Emmys. When you only have to do like 10, 11 shows, it's pretty liberating. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, who cares about the Emmys?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Nobody at this
of all the awards, I mean, I guess Grammys are kind of the same way. I mean, I don't think that it would be strange to me to imagine somebody who's sort of talented enough and creative enough to work for Mad Men and yet care about the Emmys.
Well,
I mean, I know they all go upstage and act like they're really happy when they win and stuff, but I mean, there's got to be really kind of smart, authentically creative people. I just can't imagine they would care about that.
You know what they care about? It buys security for the show and buys more seasons. Because nobody's going to cancel
on anyone. I bet what they probably mostly care about is just getting their material on to different programs. There's a whole bunch of writers. It's probably pretty competitive.
Right. Yeah, I think the Oscars are the last award show that really, truly matters for those five categories. And now they've ruined that because there's like 10 nominees for each category now.
Or will that be more interesting now?
Oh, you like that idea?
Well, I don't know if I like it or dislike it, but I wonder if it will be more interesting in the sense that will the same kind of movie still end up winning? Or will the splitting of the votes maybe make, sort of change the type of film that wins? Because I think when you only have five films, there's always this sort of this conventional wisdom that one movie is going to win, and it almost always does.
Right.
And I wonder if you add five more films there, and it creates a greater opportunity for someone to say, I know X is probably going to win, but I'm voting for Y.
Yeah. Well, it just seemed like they added too many. Like, I thought if they had gone to 7, that makes total sense. But doing it the way they did it would have been the equivalent of baseball saying, all right, we need to expand the wild card. We're going to make it 20 playoff teams now, or 16 or whatever. And I don't know. It was a little bit overboard. 7, I think we all would have been fine with 7. 7 at least would have made it a little more unpredictable.
You know, you sound a little tired today, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm on West Coast time. This is a big deal for me that doing a podcast this early. I'm doing it to accommodate you and your big book tour.
Well, no, you told me you get up at 6.
I get up at 6, but I'm not podcast.
So it's 9 o'clock there. You've been up for 3 hours. You've been up longer than I have.
I'm not coherently podcast worthy until, as Joe Mead can attest, until 10. So this is a big
extra
hour.
Well, we could have waited until then.
No, it's good.
I want to put you out.
Where are some of the places that you're going to promote this book?
Oh, almost nowhere.
You're not doing anything?
I just have a friend in town today. That's why I wanted to do it early. I don't really have not that busy. Yeah.
You're not doing any signings?
I think I'm doing 2 in New York. And then, you know, I go to colleges and talk and stuff. I'm going to, like, I don't know, Central Michigan, I think, at one point, and I'm going to Boulder, Colorado. But I'm not really touring now.
Gotcha.
Kind of like the Beatles in 68, you know, I'm just in the studio.
Hey, I'm glad you brought that up. I read that thing you wrote for the AV Club about the Beatles. I really liked it. And it is kind of fascinating to look back at that whole career. And it made me wonder, like, I have a couple thoughts here. One, it made me wonder, is there a band that came out, that a band that has started since 1990 that had that kind of career that people will be able to write about 40 years later still trying to figure them out? And then second, a reader sent me this email saying, you know, the Super Bowl was kind of like the last frontier for a band before they basically, we all agree, all right, these guys are pretty much done. They, like when the Rolling Stones played the Super Bowl or Springsteen or U2. So who are the bands that are going to be playing the Super Bowl 15 years from now?
Well, to answer your first question, no. But that really has nothing to do with the quality of music coming out post-1990. It has to do sort of with the fact of how rock and roll exists. I mean, I think I've talked, maybe we even talked about this before. You kind of have to look at rock bands the same way you look at presidents.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you know, it doesn't matter how long America exists. When people talk about the greatest presidents, Washington and Lincoln, Jefferson, they're all, you know, there's a handful of people who are always going to be in that top five category because they sort of define what a successful president is, or how, you know, the values and the criteria of what makes a good president.
Right.
The Beatles, more than any other band, sort of set that criteria. There can't be a future band who's better at being a group than the Beatles were, because all other groups are really doing is sort of fulfilling the criteria that they made.
Gotcha.
Plus, I mean, it's just, they're, at least in pop music, they're the most musical band there's ever been. I mean, I'm not saying that they're the most, there's been bands where guys had greater virtuosity, but I think if you really break down the essence of being musical, they're the most musical one of all time, clearly.
Well, for the people,
in terms of who will be playing the Super Bowl in...
Wait, hold on, Beatles. Go back to one thing. For people who haven't read that piece, and they should, it's on Google, you can get it easily. What did you think, out of all the albums that you listened to, and you listened to them sequentially, what is the one that you were the most surprised by listening to it however many years later, in a good way?
Well, surprised by.
Or just like,
wow. I guess, you know, because there's the stereo version and the mono version, and prior to the release, I was more interested in the mono versions because everyone had always said that that's what the Beatles intended. Not that, you know, they kind of, the stereo versions were kind of a throwaway, and if you really want to hear what the band is like, you're going to listen to them in mono. Then when I got them, I found that I did like the stereo versions better. I just seemed, they sounded more interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And the ones that sounded probably the most surprising to me were just really the, just before mid-period. Like listening to A Hard Day's Night again, which is a record, of course, I had played in the past, but I hadn't listened to in a while. I mean, the greatest thing about, I think, being a fan of the Beatles, and I'm not the first person who said this, lots of people have, but it's more true with them than anybody else. They can have songs that you could hear a bunch of times for 20 years,
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you'll hear it again, and it will become your favorite Beatles song. Like a song that you never had interest in before, you'll suddenly play it, and it will sound differently. That there's something about the way they construct songs that really dovetail with the maturation process of being a person. Because things sound different, and ideas in the songs seem different as you grow older, and you appreciate them differently. So it'd be really hard for me to be surprised by the Beatles. I almost expect them to surprise me. So therefore, the surprise is sort of mitigated.
What do you think are the Kobe Shaq parallels with McCartney and Lennon? That's a good question.
Okay, so you're obviously saying Shaq is Lennon.
I don't know. I'm not saying anything. I'm saying that the Beatles are the best case, or the best example of a band that had two defined alpha dogs, and eventually they just couldn't coexist anymore. And they always reminded me of what happened with Shaq and Kobe in a way, where the two alpha dogs, once Kobe decided that he also needed to be the alpha dog, it was over. And that was kind of like with the Lennon-McCartney thing. And I thought the Rolling Stone thing was really interesting 2 months ago about...
Yeah, that was a good piece.
Yeah, it was really good. I didn't realize that Lennon had that much anxiety about McCartney, about how prolific McCartney was. He couldn't handle it.
There's a Beatles book called Shout, which is probably the best known of the Beatles kind of bios, and that's extremely negative toward McCartney. And certainly the perception, kind of the intellectual perception of the Beatles in the 70s became that that Paul sort of changed the trajectory of the band in a way that was negative, and that his solo material sort of shows that he was never that serious, and John Lennon was very outspoken, of course, about, he did a Playboy interview where he really kind of dismantled this idea that they all worked together, you know, that they were really always writing as a team, and then he wrote the song How Do You Sleep, which had to be very humiliating for McCartney. But now, I think, by the 80s, and kind of now, even throughout the 90s and toward now the assumption sort of is, well, McCartney really saved the Beatles, that they probably would have ended, not only, you know, even if they would have played longer, they would have been less interesting over the last part of the 60s. And now I feel like there's a greater degree of sympathy toward McCartney. I mean, there's a lot of weird things, but I mean, like, you know, like, everybody, John Lennon was always talking about Yoko Ono and their relationship and how wonderful and sort of how it changed his life and was very transformative. And yet McCartney and Linda McCartney actually had the relationship that John Lennon pretended to have with Yoko Ono.
Right.
And you know, Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney in their entire marriage, they only spent one night apart.
I mean, wow.
All those years, just when he got arrested for marijuana in Japan. That was the only night they didn't sleep together.
That's
interesting. They had a really romantic, I mean, that was real romance, you know.
Well, and he was also just as guilty of sticking her in musically in different things as Lennon was.
I mean, he had her play, you know, keyboards and sing backup on Wings records. They turned her voice way down. I mean, it's like if you play Wings, you don't hear Linda McCartney that clearly. They were... All four of those guys, were on their second marriage. And all four of them had very successful second marriages, really. You know, I think, like, Ringo and Barbara Bach, I think they've been married for, I don't know how many years now. They got married in the 70s, and they're staying.
Right.
So they were all sort of able to, I think what happened was that their lives changed so radically that none of their first marriages had a chance. And then when they actually became the people who they are, they were sort of able to find people who matched up with them. I mean, but this is why the Beatles are so interesting. I mean, they're the only band that you can really sustain a long, compelling conversation about their second wives. Like, every detail of the band is worth talking about.
I know. When I read that Rolling Stone thing, I was like, oh, my God, I'm not going to read another Beatles thing. There can't possibly be new information. And, like, 20 minutes later, I'm totally into it and just eating up everything. You know, talking about Shaq and Kobe, the Lennon-McCartney parallel that I think is interesting is now maybe the way Shaq has been portrayed with some of the stuff that happened in Phoenix, and now you look back at his career and he's now left four teams on bad terms. And yet when the Shaq-Kobe thing self-destructed in L.A., everybody said, oh yeah, it's Kobe's fault. Kobe wanted him out. And by the way, I was one of those people. But It's all Kobe's fault. Kobe wanted his own team. Kobe demanded that. They traded Shaq. Shaq got a raw deal. Shaq goes to Miami. He's the good guy. He plays with Dwayne Wade. He has a big comeback season. And now with a little bit of time to look back, it's like, was Shaq kind of an a-hole? You know, like maybe Shaq was fat that entire last season. He played with the Lakers. He was out of shape. They didn't get along with Kobe, resented him. Maybe he was more to blame than we realize.
Behavior just matters less than the perception of that behavior. It doesn't really matter what Shaq did. He is perceived as being a nicer, more affable, more playful guy.
Right.
And the thing is that Kobe just doesn't... Like, it's almost as though he sees other people be liked, and he just it's just mystifying to him. And instead of just trying to give up, he tries to sort of create what he thinks a likable person is like, and it never works. And for Shaq, that comes easier than playing basketball.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, Shaq can easily deal with media and all that stuff. But, man, the stuff that came out, you know, after he played for the Suns and basically he stole Nash's reality TV show and they had to give Nash an executive producer credit, they gave him away to get rid of him, not just his contract, but, you know, he really impacted that team in a lot of negative ways, and it's just starting to come out, like some of the stuff he did behind the scenes. Now you look like Orlando, poisons that situation, starts a feud with Penny Hardaway. Lakers, now that we're looking back, maybe he did poison that situation a little, doesn't talk to Kobe, leaves on bad terms. Miami leaves on bad terms. I don't know. I have this basketball book coming out that hasn't even been printed yet, and I already feel like the Shaq section is dated. I feel like he needs to be totally reevaluated.
Well, although you're still, I mean, the thing about your book, though, is you're talking about the real value these guys have. Now, it's hard to make the argument that Shaq's behavior has stopped his teams from being successful.
Well, you could definitely say
they made the Suns worse, but the Suns were just kind of guessing. Also, I do have to say one thing in Shaq's corner. He did steal Nash's idea for that reality show, but it never gets made with Steve Nash.
I mean,
maybe on the Canadian channel they show it, but Steve Nash is not a big enough celebrity that he's going to be able to draw people to watch him compete against other athletes who, at least in Shaq's case, are generally less famous than him.
Yeah,
maybe the exception of Phelps. But with Nash, he would. I don't know if he's not a bad actor, but I don't know if he's charismatic enough for a show like that in America.
Well, and also, it wasn't the totally most original idea. Like George Plimpton wrote a whole book about playing with people.
Well, okay, that's a pretty tough criteria. That was a lot of years ago, and he was
a lot of years ago.
Yeah.
But then somebody else got Todd Gallagher, who's now suing Shaq. He wrote a book about, I forget the title, it's called, it's something with Andy Roddick in it, but he played against all these different athletes in this
sport. I met that dude. Andy Roddick beat me with a frying pan.
Yeah, that's what it is, yeah. So and this idea had been around for a while, but it's just interesting to me that now Shaq's on team number 5, and, I think he's a big risk for the Cavs, because we have never seen from him that he can totally be happy as the supporting sidekick. He claims he could be happy, and we've seen it a little bit, but even when Dwayne Wade won the title in 2006, Shaq was right there, and I wrote about this when it happened, like Shaq basically like, here's your trophy, and the insinuation was always like, I kind of let this happen, instead of just saying like, it's Dwayne Wade's team, I'm just here.
Speaking of the Cavs, what did you think of LeBron's cancer scare?
Where is this going?
Well, I just thought it was interesting that his quote about it was that I wasn't scared, but it wasn't something I was comfortable with.
Yeah, that is an interesting cancer quote.
Someone could feasibly be comfortable with maybe having mouth cancer. I mean, of course he's not going to be. It was just a strange way to address it to the media. I'm sure he just had to say something. But, like, he didn't want to somehow imply he was scared. I don't know if he authentically wasn't or if he thought that his sort of perception demands that he seem fearless. But I thought it was interesting he used the word comfortable in regarding the possibility of having mouth cancer.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by LeBron in general. I don't know. Have you ever spent time with him?
No.
I only spent like 20 minutes with him once, but this was a few years ago, but he's a lot more polished, I think, now. But I think when you look at like the old Jordan interviews that Jordan did, like there's Letterman clips on YouTube from the 80s of when Jordan went on there. And LeBron is so far ahead of where Jordan was from a personality, charisma standpoint. And he's only, I think, 25 now, something like that. But, you know, 18 months ago he hosted the ESPYs. I don't think 23-year-old Jordan could have done that. I'm kind of fascinated to see where his career goes. I have no idea where he's going to be playing a year from now. I have no idea, like, is he going to start a movie production company? Is he going to be doing TV shows? Like, where is he going to get lose his focus because he's going to be trying to do 15 things? What happens to him?
I'm torn because I like the idea of him staying in Cleveland in a way that, you know, if he grew up there, played his whole career there, he really has a chance to become the most iconic figure in the history of Ohio, a state that's had tons of presidents. Like, he would be the most, because he would just, his whole essence would have, you know, been there. Because I live in New York, I hope he comes here. I would like it if he was playing here. It would be nice if it would be interesting and fun, and it would be more fun to go to the games. Have you talked yet? Have you written about or done a podcast yet about Jordan's Hall of Fame induction speech?
I talked about it with one person, but I'd love to talk about it again. I mentioned it. I wrote about it a little bit in a mailbag about, I got this great email from a reader who said how if Jordan had remained married, that he would have run his idea for that speech by his wife, and his wife would have said, MJ, or Michael, you can't do that. That you're going to come off like an ass. Like, you got to be more diplomatic. And he would have ended up making the tweaks. But now that he's dating this 29-year-old Cuban model or whatever, he probably told her what he was going to do, and she probably just nodded. But I thought it was
possible.
A disaster.
You're a big advocate of the Jordan was whipped by his wife trope.
Well, not
that's
whipped.
Part of, that's part of your book too. That he's like he's loving life, playing cards, and all of a sudden his wife shows up, and it's like party's over. So maybe that's true. I don't know if on paper, if Jordan's speech seems the way it comes across when delivered. Okay, like if that speech is delivered by, oh, I'm trying to think of somebody who's like really hard to find an athlete who's like really self-deprecating or something. Bob Uecker, okay?
Right.
If Bob Uecker gives that speech about all the people in his life who he felt wronged him, I think people would love it. But it was sort of the way Jordan delivered it, and the fact that he did seem a little drunk during the speech, but not drunk enough to be having fun, just drunk enough to get mean, like he was drinking gin or something. And it was just, as I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, like, I wonder if I'm imagining how this is coming across. And then, of course, I went to the internet and I realized everybody thought this.
We should say for clarity that we don't know if Michael Jordan was drinking. You're saying your perception as you watched it was that,
I didn't say he was drinking gin. I'm saying it seemed like he was drinking gin to me, having no knowledge of, you know. I mean, that just might be how it is. Every time you hang out with Jordan, he's like this. But I think it did present an interesting tipping point, sort of, in his career trajectory. Because we had spoken about him, I don't know, last year or something, and I had mentioned how what sort of amazing about Jordan is he is the one guy who, no matter what he does negatively, always comes out as a reason to like him more. You know?
I put that in my book. I credited you. He could do anything to anybody, and people would spin it in a way like, he's so competitive. You know, maybe it's just a
speech, though, changes that to me a little bit.
Because
all the other things, all the things that he did, could be seen as almost this thing he can't control, okay? He can't control how competitive he is. He can't help but cheat in a game of cards to win. He's almost overtaken by the rush of competition.
Yep.
But this did not seem like that. This seemed like that his kind of his competitive urge is not this sort of unconscious, organic thing. It's like he sits around being bitter about this in a way that now makes him seem sort of almost out of touch with reality.
Like,
why is he questioning the height of a guy he went to high school with? That just seems weird to me. that he would, you know, but why would you, because it's got to be the kind of thing that would only be troubling to the guy himself. And you would only know that it's troubling if you went to high school with him.
It reminded me, and I'm not sure if you've ever been to a wedding where this happened, but I think most of us have been to a wedding where somebody gives a really inappropriate wedding speech. And about the 5 minute mark, you realize that it's just going to go to a place that nobody's ready for. And that's what it reminded me of. Pretty early on, you were like, oh man, this is going to be awkward. You could just kind of feel it. And supposedly I wasn't there, but I did talk to probably 6 or 7 people who were there. And they were just all staggered after. They said it was much worse in person. And really, he didn't write anything down, which was another issue. You know, I think when you go up and ad lib in general, it's a bad idea. Even if you're doing like a best man speech, it's a bad idea. But to do a Hall of Fame speech with cameras and ad lib it, bad idea.
Well, I mean, that being the case, he seemed to do a pretty good job of delivering the ideas he wanted to get across. It was just bizarre that those were the, I mean, it did make me, in a way, for the first time in my life, I guess maybe when his dad died, this would be the only other time, where I kind of felt bad for the person. Because
yeah.
He can't enjoy being the best at something everyone knows he's the best at. And he just can't appreciate it. It makes him mad that people don't think he's better.
He and Gretzky have handled it in different ways. I think both poorly in each case, but it manifests itself in different ways. But I think Gretzky's at that point, too. I don't think Gretzky is... I think when you are so great at something that you've just completely transformed the way somebody thinks about the ceiling of a basketball player or a hockey player or whatever, I don't know if there's any follow-up act you can have. What do you do? What do you do for the next 40 years after that? You just sit around and
bring up something about the Gretzky 30 for 30 documentary. I know you were a big fan of that.
I liked it.
Yeah, I feel as though that they failed to sort of address the core element of that dispute, though, which was the belief at the time and to this day that Gretzky did want to go to L.A. and that his wife did want him to go there. They kind of just mention it in passing.
Well, there was a lot of read-between-the-line stuff with that, and I actually...
focus of the documentary is that tearful press conference he gives,
right.
I think it would make someone who knew nothing of the event assume that this was the worst moment in Gretzky's life. And I don't think that's how he felt at the time.
I think he felt really, really super guilty is why he cried. I really do. I think my personal take on the whole thing is this. I think he started dating an actress. He spent the previous summer in L.A., you know, courting her and doing the whole thing and living in L.A. and it was sunny every day and he'd go to restaurants and people didn't bother him because of the whole code that's out here, the celebrity code. And now he goes back to Edmonton. He's in this fishbowl. He can't even go buy a thing of milk without 10 people coming up to him. And I think he just had L.A. in his mind the whole time thinking, yeah, I could just live in L.A. I wouldn't have to deal with this stuff anymore. Because he told us at the panel, and I wish this had been in the film, but the problem is it was only 52 minutes, and there's stuff that you can't include. But he had a choice, basically, between Detroit and L.A. And he wanted to go to L.A., and his wife wanted to go to Detroit. Which
I don't believe that.
I kind of don't either.
Said that, but I don't believe it. I like Colts. The Colts band one was really good, although I must admit, wish there'd been less about the band.
Well,
those guys would not stop talking about themselves. There's all this interesting... I mean, I realized that was the conceit that kind of ties it together and that
right.
It's just kind of through thread, but there was so much interesting stuff there, like the period when they tried to adopt Canadian football. While I totally remember the Colts leaving, I guess I was too young. I did not remember Ursay being such a lush.
I don't either. Like it was right before SportsCenter had really taken off. And that, you know, if that press conference had happened in 2009, obviously it would go through the whole sports cycle that we have now. But in 1981 or whatever it happened, like, you know, when are they going to replay
that? It couldn't happen today. Press conference could not happen. There's no way that anybody in the front office would allow the situation to occur, you know. I mean, that could happen on the street if they ambushed him or something.
It was the Joe Namath, Susie Colbert interview, but for 14 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Basically. The part, I mean, that was another case where I love the Levinson documentary. I wish he had had like three more minutes to kind of delve into the Cleveland thing a little, because the irony of it was that
they took Cleveland's team. Like, oh, we felt bad for him.
Yeah.
Essentially, the identical thing had happened.
But I guess there's no way to do that. It would be the, you know, if I do a documentary about how sad you were that your wife left you, and then the documentary ended with, but Chuck found happiness. He stole somebody else's wife. And now he's happy. But is it, so that part was the one catch with that, that I just, and I don't think the Ravens fans feel fantastic about it, to be honest. I think that Browns component always makes them feel a little bit iffy.
I don't know how conscious they are, but I feel
a little bit.
I feel like that kind of fandom doesn't really have much of a sense of context. I think, I mean, if you're really a big Ravens fan, you love the team, you're not really thinking about how they got there. Have you at all watched the Full Color Football series on Showtime about AFL?
I have all five on TiVo, and I am going to find the right one. I thought I was going to be this weekend, but for some reason, the History Channel had Kennedy Declassified Week. And I don't know, I went on a Kennedy assassination rampage this weekend. It was just...
they try to tie that into the AFL thing. It's good.
Oh, really?
Sometimes they really want us to, you know, like Dan Rather, I believe Dan Rather is in it. He talks about the Houston Oilers a great deal because he grew up in Houston. It's strange that they really do want to give the sense of, like, you know, the 60s. The world was changing, and this is why the AFL happened. And that part seems kind of forced. But the footage is actually good. It was a lot of footage I haven't seen before.
Yeah, they dug out. I think they found a whole new treasure chest of stuff. You forget how great the uniforms were, too. And it's
although they now we forget less because they actually when we watch games.
But. They throw back. Yeah, I was watching one of the Kennedy things this weekend. I forgot what a complex the city of Dallas had after the whole JFK thing. And then I was thinking, like, how weird it was that the Cowboys were somehow lifted that complex and made it okay to root for Dallas again in other parts of the country. Because remember there was that whole weird period where everybody blamed Dallas, and Dallas was the JFK city? Then they became the Cowboys city.
That was still when Dallas was playing in the Cotton Bowl. I do feel as though that the national perception of the Cowboys started to change when they built Texas Stadium.
And well, that's sort of Staubach.
Kind of the, what?
With Staubach, it's kind of...
Oh, totally, yes.
Yes.
But also just sort of the unconscious rebranding of what the franchise was supposed to be. And then when they actually were branded as America's team, by that point it was pretty, you know... And that's never going to change now. I don't think there's ever going to be a point where the Cowboys aren't the most nationally popular team.
Do you ever go on binges like Kennedy Assassination Weekend? Do you do that with TV?
Yes. I do a lot of binging in my life.
Do you like History Channel? Is that when you tune
to? History Channel at times, I find as though that sometimes the description of the program is much better than the program itself.
True.
Like they will say something like, you know, like the truth behind Hitler's relationship to the occult.
Yeah.
And I'll watch it and I don't learn that much, you know. I feel like the Learning Channel actually does a better job with that kind of stuff than the History Channel.
Really?
Plus, the History Channel often seems to be showing the winds of war, which is fiction. Like, there should be no fiction on the History Channel.
There's also a lot of Nostradamus.
Yes.
In the History Channel.
He plays a key role in their evaluation of history.
It really does. It's like everyone's tied to Nostradamus and some prediction he had somehow in some way. No matter anything that happened in history can somehow be tied to him. But then when you actually hear the theory laid out, it's always like kind of convoluted. I watched one that reminded me of the great description that didn't deliver. This weekend they had one about the 24 hours after JFK's assassination. It's like, what happened in those 24 hours? I was like, oh, this will be good. And it was basically, the gist of the program was that the Kennedys didn't like LBJ that much and it was awkward on the plane. And everybody had a lot to drink. And I was like, all right, we're done with this exciting 24 hours after. So I do think they reach for some of the programming. But I don't know if you saw, they had this show called JFK, Three Shots That Changed America. And what they did was they just used all the real footage. They didn't interview any talking heads after the fact. There was no, no dramatics, 2009 CGI or anything. It was just the actual footage from 1963 all the way through now and how things were covered. So, like, they had a clip of the first time they showed the Zapruder film, and it was on some weird show Geraldo Rivera had in like 1975. It was like, okay, now this is the first time this has ever been shown, the Zapruder film. And they show it, and the JFK's head gets blown off, and the crowd goes, oh! Like, it was one of those sounds. And I don't know. I think you would like this show. It's pretty good.
I probably would. I have no doubt that I would.
It's and I didn't realize, like, they cut into As the World Turns. So they actually show, like, the As the World Turns episode, and then it cuts into, oh, we have a news bulletin, something's happened in Dallas.
Oswald? Because, I mean, my dad was actually, has mentioned how he was, he actually saw Oswald get shot. He was in the bar with a bunch of guys.
They showed it. I mean, this was, like, the greatest television moment of all time. That everybody was watching because he's about to be arraigned, and they actually, Jack Ruby jumps out and shoots him right in front of the camera.
Well, you know, I guess we've never ever discussed this, but you strike me as not a big conspiracy person. Are you a conspiracy person outside of the NBA lottery?
And outside of MJ playing baseball? I like hearing all the theories. I think the Kennedy assassination is the best one because the theories go in so many different directions. I mean, there's that whole part about the three tramps under the tunnel, and one of them was Woody Harrelson's dad. You heard that one, right?
Well, I'm not sure, to be honest.
Well, it's just there was allegedly the CIA was involved, and why they were involved, one of the reasons was this picture and these three tramps that were under the tunnel that the car ended up going through all match pictures of what CIA guys look like, and one of those people was Charles Harrelson, Woody Harrelson's father. That's a weird story.
We'll play into two of your interests. We're playing your interest of both Kennedy and gambling.
Yeah.
Okay. Set the odds for the following. I will say the possibility, and you tell me the odds that it's true.
Okay. I love this question.
Oswald acted alone.
0% chance. I'm going to say zero.
Okay, so that's you'd a million to one. What would you put the odds? You wouldn't even put it up.
I would say I would not put it up because there's no way he acted alone.
Okay. Kennedy was killed primarily because he was going to splinter the CIA.
I think that
the CIA was behind this because he had openly said he was going to splinter it.
I think that's the best theory of the bunch. I do.
So
I would say 5-2.
5-2. Okay.
Yeah.
That he was killed ultimately by
Cubans?
Cuba, or by extension Russia. That they were ultimately the driving force behind getting Kennedy shot.
I would put Cuba at 6-1, and I would put Russia at 8-1. I think if either of those countries did it, I don't think they used somebody like Oswald. He's kind of a loser. Oswald wasn't
but
like
was,
the kind
he was involved with Russia, what you know, obviously.
Yeah, but I think, and that's why the odds would be relatively low. But my whole theory is, I think Oswald independently just wanted to kill Kennedy. I think the CIA was also trying to kill Kennedy, and I think it was a giant coincidence that Oswald shot him right before the CIA shot him. And I think they fired two shots from the grassy knoll, because if you watch the Zapruder film frame by frame, Connolly kind of jerks back right before the shot hits Kennedy in the head. I think they fired two shots. The first one hit Connolly, second one hit JFK. That's
okay,
my convoluted
now,
theory.
Oswald is then silenced by Jack Ruby, who has all of these underworld ties and was going to die from, I believe, cancer in a couple months.
Yes.
Frank Sinatra was very upset with JFK because he basically helped him steal the election in Chicago. And
I think Sinatra's
JFK,
above.
Well, here's the deal. This is where I'm going to. Basically, Kennedy beat Nixon because of voter fraud in Illinois, which was driven by the mob there,
yes.
Which the connection was Sinatra. So, did Sinatra know that Kennedy was going to be assassinated?
Ooh,
I'm not saying he was involved in any way in terms of paying for it, but did he know it was going to happen?
That would be the mafia theory, which I would put at 5-1, because there is evidence that Kennedy might have shared mistresses with a couple of the wrong mobsters. And that one seems a little more reliable to me, only because of it explains the Jack Ruby part. You know what I mean?
Well, Jack Ruby's involvement seems to prove that to some degree the underworld was involved. It's just too weird, especially since he was a dying man. That just seems incredibly strange.
The whole thing was strange. Like, how did he even get in with a gun? It's just that the 1960s are so crazy when you look back and you think, how does somebody just walk into this Oswald's being transported to another jail because they fear for his safety, and yet Jack Ruby's standing right there next to the cops with a gun? This is the way the 60s
another
worked.
Interesting detail I've always been fascinated by. Everybody remembers where they were when Kennedy was shot. They were alive at that time. Every single person. You talk to one of your teachers, you talk to your parents, whatever, they all remember. You know who's the one person who says he can't recall? George Bush.
Really?
Who was in the CIA at the time, has said, when asked where he was when Kennedy was shot, does not recall.
Huh. I love the fact that I sprung this on you out of nowhere and you somehow have been able to carry 10 minutes of material here.
Well,
you're a Hall of Fame podcast guest.
You know, there was something I wanted to talk to you about in kind of an abstract way, though.
Wait, hold on, though. We never went. You never answered the second Super Bowl question.
Oh, who do I think will perform in the Super Bowl in 15 years?
2022.
Well, they'll probably start duplicating artists at some point. Like Bruce Springsteen and U2 will probably play again. I guarantee you Stevie Wonder will play again because he'll play for any of these things.
Okay.
It would be interesting if that became a venue for major rock reunions. For instance, if there was a Guns N' Roses reunion in 10 years, it would seem like the Super Bowl would be a strange but possible place for that. At some point, they're going to start using hip-hop artists, I would guess.
Really? You think?
What?
You think, has that bridge really been crossed? I mean, I guess the closest
it's going to be 10 years, probably, but maybe less.
I think
Run DMC will be the first, the surviving members of Run DMC performing again with Aerosmith at the Super Bowl would seem very possible.
All right, but not 15 years from now.
Well,
Aerosmith, I don't think we'll be able to perform in 15 years.
Well, that's true. I guess it might just be, just Steven Tyler or something. That's a good point, I guess. It'll be interesting when these guys are dying, too. I mean, it's also possible that they will move away from rock-oriented halftime shows. I mean, that's kind of a new thing. It's not going to exist for perpetuity. It's probably going... At some point, there will probably be the ability to use holograms in a more practical way. And we'll go through a period. I guarantee this is going to happen. I guarantee there will be a period in the future where hologram-oriented halftime shows will be in vogue.
I'm glad you brought this up because I'm excited to be a talking hologram on some ESPN show someday. It would bring me close to my goal of never having to leave my house. Like, I could just be on 5 good minutes on PTI and I'm in a hologram, but I'm actually, sitting in my office. All right, that's going to wrap up part one. We're going to talk so long here that I think we're going to have to go to two parts. So tune into part two of the BS Report with Chuck Klosterman on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Find that on ESPN.com or iTunes right now.
Target the sound off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed. You cried. You turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. Thus concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all this talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news. The $5 footlong anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 footlongs, like the Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 footlong and the Pile Ridiculously High BLT $5 footlong, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.